After I went home last week, after Edwin asked that question about attunement, I sort of woke up in the night and I thought, you talked about clothes. What could you have been thinking? And I just thought it just really seemed strange to me. I woke up the next morning and I had the thought really clearly, so I wrote myself a note. It also helped me realize when Joe mentioned it that I was bringing the Revelations book instead of the Gita. I mean, we sort of have all these different scriptures in our head right now, but I wrote myself a note so I wouldn't forget. The question was about attunement, and I started talking about wearing clothes that Swami, colors that Swami likes, and so on. And I mean, gosh, you're talking about the key to self-realization, and I'm talking about, you know, shopping, which just was more than a little embarrassing. But the reason I brought it up, I often talk about what's clear in my mind is what I'm learning. And the actual relationship to that, and I had talked some weeks before about cooking, which is also seems relatively trivial in the scheme of things, but it had actually come to me in a backward sort of fashion. I became aware of the fact that when engaged, even in such seemingly trivial things, I noticed that my mind was still referring them back to the spiritual principles as I understand them. And that was really what I was trying to illustrate. It wasn't really that what color dresses you wear or anything like that. It happens to be a particular interest of mine. But the point is, if you're going to be a disciple, you never stop being a disciple. And the question is whether our lives will be ruled, as I think it was Lahiri Mahashaya said, or Sri Yukteswar, by whims and fancies, or whether it will actually be ruled by the constant influence of the guru. And there's just this constant practice that in many ways, the small experiences, they're not more important than the big ones, but they're not unimportant by any stretch. Because it's a question of, do we just go on business as usual and just follow whatever we think? Or do we realize that everything in our life has been given to God and there's no area of our life that we shouldn't be thinking about pleasing the guru, in essence? In my life, Swami Kriyananda has played that role and he's personified that energy. And through him, for all of us, there is sort of an Ananda way, which is by no means rules or anything like that, but there's an Ananda way. When we first started creating this colony 20 years ago, even earlier than that, when I first started traveling and teaching and went to Seattle and Portland and basically laid the groundwork for what became the colonies there, it was very interesting for me to try to figure out what do people need to know in order to fit into the reality of Ananda. Because at that point, I was coming from Ananda Village, which is not merely the first community, but it's the most total of our communities. And at that time, it was really the only community. When you said Ananda, you meant Ananda Village. We had to train ourselves to say Ananda Village in order to give credibility to the Ananda branches. Because people would say, well, I live at Ananda, and then people here would think, well, I do too. But they meant Ananda Village. So because what we've done up there, and especially what we were doing in those first 15 years, was basically pulling away from the culture as it existed, and under the guidance of Swamiji, under his inspiration of how Master would want this to be, we created an entire alternate culture. And Swami, in the subsequent years, has written books explaining all of those things. Leadership, relationship to money, relationship to the arts, architecture, psychology, whatever else there is. You know all the different books that there are. He's written, really, you just look around and you think every aspect of life is covered by what he's written. But he created it first and then he wrote it down. We had schools, we had businesses, we had artistic presentations, we had social life, we had all those things, and then he wrote books about them. But what it was, if self-realization is the goal, if Kriya is the practice, if Master is the guru, then what happens to all of life? And everything just had to have a new form, because this is what we're going to talk about in a few minutes when I actually talk about tonight. You know, what is right action? everything has a new form. I can see that I could go straight into that, but I'll try to resist. And so when we started moving out from Ananda Village, at the time that David and I moved here, which was 1987, Anant and Maria moved to Sacramento. The Ananda House was still going in San Francisco, but it changed leaders every year and a half or so. At that time, we had Sacramento and San Francisco as branches. We might have been working a little with Ocean Song, which was a community on the coast that never really made it. It lasted 7 years, and then the land was supposed to be donated to us, and when it was clear it was never going to come to us, we had to close up and come back. But nobody ever seriously considered replicating it. Basically, the branches of the communities outside of Ananda Village were just considered doorways for people to come to Ananda Village. And no one who went to live in a colony ever expected to stay. It was considered an exile assignment. And you lasted about 18 months, and then you got to come home, which is just how you thought about it. There was just no serious thought of how we were really going to do this until the astral hour. Swami wrote the Festival of Light. He created the concept of light bearers. He sent Ananta and Maria to Sacramento. He sent David and me here, and it was just a different moment in time. So we had to start thinking, how do we replicate everything? And it was lots of fun, especially if you look back on all the first 5 or 6 years of all the program guides, when basically I was nearly single-handed in just teaching every single class there was, just trying to figure out what we needed. I mean, there were essential things that people had to learn. They had to learn how to cook. They had to learn how to have a good time together. They had to learn what kind of music to listen to. They had to know P.G. Woodhouse. I mean, they really had to know P.G. Woodhouse. It was a fundamental part of Ananda society was P.G. Woodhouse, not merely for himself and all the references to lines that nobody would understand. There's in one of the plays, for example, Bertie Wooster gets himself into terrible trouble in front of a whole academy of girls. He's telling them off-color jokes because he doesn't know what else to do. And the director of the school stands up suddenly and says, "We will now sing the school song," like that, trying to save the day. That line is often used in the context of Ananda. When things start going really bad, someone will say, "We will now sing the school song," just meaning we've got to get off this topic and go somewhere. And everybody who knows, you know, just starts laughing because you understand exactly what's going on. I mean, it's a small thing, but it's all part of a culture. But part of that is that Swamiji has a certain understanding of what's appropriate diet that he learned from Master. He has a certain understanding of self-respect through how you present yourself to the world. I mean, these are all real questions, because there are spiritual groups in which everybody only wears white, or it's considered really out of tune, you know, to think at all about your clothes, or the women dress like men, or everyone wears Indian clothes. You know, it just could be any number of things, because you have to wear something. And so on what basis are you going to make even the most trivial decisions? Because they all add up to, do I allow my life to be run by whims and fancies? Or do I attune myself in every dimension of my reality to the inward presence of God? And to me, it was interesting to me to see how habituated I had become in those two particular areas. And I did mention that Swamiji had put a lot of energy into me to increase my sense of self-respect. And so for me, how I dressed was actually an important spiritual practice. But because of that initial influence, and actually cooking too, I wrote some of that in Swami Kriyananda, as we have known him. Both of those things were strongly influenced by Swami. But the result of that is that in those very trivial areas, my mind goes in that direction, and often in that direction. But what I see from that is the good karma to have developed a spiritual practice, which is, why should I make any decision just according to what I want? One of my friends remarked, because many of us, including me, have been in a position of responsibility for creating magnetic energy to draw others into Ananda for a very long time. From my very earliest years at Ananda, I was working at the retreat and running the kitchen and teaching classes. And I mean, I can't remember a time when I've ever been at Ananda when I wasn't at least partially, if not wholly, responsible for generating the right energy and magnetism. And as a result of that, of course, you have to put out energy. It really doesn't matter. Well, as my friend put it to me, she said it like this: I wonder what kind of a personality I would have, she said, if I had the freedom to have one. You know, the discussion was being extroverted, introverted, being outgoing, being quiet, you know, being liking crowds, not liking crowds. We both just laughed. How long has it been since you really stopped to think what you prefer? What does it matter what you prefer? It's like, do you want your life to be ruled by whims and fancies, as Sri Yukteswar said, or do you want to align your will with the will of the Guru? And he'll reach you often through very small things, because it's not easy, you know, it's not easy to access the deep levels. Often the doorway into the deep levels is through the small levels. In my particular case, the way I dressed, I've told you the story of the white dress, I'm sure. Haven't I told you the story of the white dress? That Swami just made me buy this white dress and wear it. And it was just like, it was so hard for me. But, of course, I've never forgotten. And I've watched myself repeatedly sort of try to sink back into basically low energy. And that's what that dress represented, which I couldn't match for. I couldn't come anywhere near that dress. I wore it once, and then I managed to lose it. You know, I never wore it twice. I just couldn't come anywhere close to it, but it was always out there. And it always represented to me, you know, just aligning your will with divine understanding and service in all situations. And often I was starting to say, also in the book about Swami, there's the story I tell about learning how to work the little spark thing to start the gas, to light the gas ring instead of the match. Swami absolutely insisted that I learn to use that thing, because I couldn't use it, because my mind was so restless, I couldn't keep it together long enough to do all the four or five motions simultaneously. And he couldn't just say to me, you have a terribly restless mind. I mean, you know, what am I going to do with information like that? That's what Swamiji said. Master almost never directly told people anything. Or if he did, it was just a sentence. You know, just a sentence or a few words. As Swamiji put it to a group of us once, he said it this way: you have no idea how lucky you are. He said, I bend over backwards to explain things to you. He said, Master never bothered. Master would just, you know, just drop a little phrase, a couple of words, even sometimes just a look, and then he would just leave it to you to rise to it intuitively, where Swami tries to build all these rational bridges and so on. But still, you know, Master could see every thought that everyone was thinking, but one of the reasons he never said things directly is because you can't affect your character like that. Oh, I shouldn't be so restless anymore. Okay, I won't be from now on. Like, what can you do with that? But he instead insisted that I learn to work that little sparker. And so there I am cooking, and, you know, I'm just cooking. I can just strike a match and light the burner instead of picking up what I would call that damn thing and having to spend all that time trying to make it work, when all I was really trying to do was just boil water. But that was what he had told me to do, so that's what I had to do. But you can see, because there's a much deeper purpose behind it. Because in all things, we have to reorient ourselves. So I just wanted to give that a little more intelligence then. I don't know if I did or not last week, but I certainly woke up in the night thinking, boy, that was weird. Okay. Any questions or comments about that or thoughts? But don't practice when it's easier. You know, practice when you think it's too trivial to matter. Because then you are less invested. When it really matters, you're really invested, and then it's hard to switch. Practice when it's easier. When do you not want to be practicing the presence of God? I mean, think of a time when you don't want to be. Think of a time when you'd rather just follow your ego. You know, I want to be free from my ego, but not always. Sometimes I just want to be bound by it. It's like, why? Okay? So, Chapter 15, Freedom Through Action, extremely important section of the Gita, which we go partially through today. So to read verses, of which there are quite a few this time. Okay, we're in chapter 3 of the Gita, verse 17. For him whose only love is the self, who delights in the self, and is content to rest in the self, no duty remains. 3:18. Such a person has nothing to gain by performing action in this world, nor anything to lose by not performing it. He is dependent on no one and nothing outside the self. 3.19. Therefore, be conscientious during the performance of all actions, whether physical or spiritual, to act without attachment. By activity without self-interest, one attains the supreme. 3.20. By the path of right action alone, Raja Janaka and others like him, karma yogis, attained perfection. To offer guidance to others, you too should be active. 3.21. Whatever the superior being does, lesser beings imitate his behavior. Whatever the superior being does, lesser beings imitate. His behavior sets the standard for right living to the world. O son of Pritha, Arjuna, no further duty compels me. This is Krishna speaking. There is no state left for me to attain, and nothing in the three worlds, material, astral, and causal, for me to gain. Yet still I work on for the upliftment of others. There, where all such good work is done, am I. 3.23. O Partha, Arjuna, if I were to cease acting in creation for even a moment, man too would imitate my inactivity. 3.24. If I were to cease being active in cosmic creation, the universe itself would cease to exist. Confusion would result, and mankind would be brought to ruin. That's the last one. These whole chapters, Freedom Through Action, which is what we're working on now, is one of the really heart of the Bhagavad Gita issues, because one of the things that the Bhagavad Gita is really about is about karma yoga. It's a battlefield, it's a fight, it's about action. It deals completely and entirely also with the inward realities and the cessation of all work and the rising above all karma and the simply being beyond it within and doing nothing but meditating. But it also deals with the ordinary person who has many duties in the world and has to carry them out. But just what I was saying a few moments ago, the whole culture of Ananda has been created. If self-realization is the goal, Kriya is the practice, and Master is the Guru, what happens to everything that we do? And everything that we do, Ananda, as it is, as an example, is based on the teachings of Krishna, the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, and this is like a distinguishing quality in the way that we function, is that we're not merely active for activity's sake, because there are great many teachings, especially the way Christianity is presented these days, that is really all about social service. And many times people criticize Ananda because of our lack of social activism, our lack of social projects. We were, David and I used to be more active in the Palo Alto Ministers Association. We haven't been participating for some time, but part of what was a little bit difficult for us is that basically an enormous amount of their concept of ministry was helping poor people. And this building they call the Opportunity Center, which is down here near university on El Camino, was the inspiration of, I think they were Episcopal ministers, and they raised money from all the congregations, and it's all to help the homeless people. And it's certainly a very worthy cause. But the interest and the energy that that whole group puts toward these things constantly, you know, David and I would just sort of sit silently. There was just nothing we could say. We certainly didn't want to speak against it, but there was no entree point for our reality within it, because it was good works for the sake of good works. There wasn't the basis behind it, which is what the Gita talks about, which is spiritual freedom through that action. It was what you might call action for good karma, or to help God make this world better, or to ease your social conscience, or whatever. Not bad motivations, but not necessarily Ananda culture motivations. And yet, at the same time, there is the other side of a spiritual path such as ours, in which the concept is that the inner reality is the greater reality, and that we're really only here to realize God, which makes you either inactive or indifferent or inappropriately indifferent to the things of this world. And without that motivating energy towards selfless service, it's very easy for a person to fall into self-deception or into tamasic energy, into laziness, or just become, instead of free of the sense of self, more and more involved in it. So Krishna, you know, weaves this path right down the middle, where on one hand you have the actionless state of spirit, which is what we're all trying to aspire to, in which this entire world is a dream, and what difference does it make? And that's a point of view that we really endorse. But then on the other side of it, as it says in the Gita, the superior being sets the standard, and the whole world imitates him. So you look at the actual proponents, the actual leaders of our path. You look at particularly at Paramahansa Yogananda and at his disciple Swami Kriyananda, whom we know very well, and they work and work and work and work. You know, Master was very, very active. He was deeply in the spirit at all times, but look how much he accomplished. First he came to America and he crisscrossed the country with these huge spiritual campaigns, lecturing to thousands of people and giving classes. And then he went to Los Angeles and he worked extremely hard to buy Mount Washington and build the Lake Shrine and develop Encinitas. And he made inventions and he started schools and he wanted to have a university. And I mean, his mind was always working to make things better for the world, to teach people how to be healthy, how to eat right, how to be successful. You know, a great deal of what he did that was not the most obvious is archived in the SRF libraries, and it's only gradually coming out through our primarily through our efforts and our capacity to access unpublished material. The Crystal Clarity Publishing is on its third book of Master's unpublished teachings. They did How to Be Happy All the Time, Karma, Death, and Reincarnation. Now they're about to publish Spiritual Relationships, and then they're going to publish The Laws of Success and an expanded version of that. Then they're going to do one about health and diet. And actually, they were talking about Master's cookbook. I mean, Master made up lots and lots of vegetarian recipes. He was a very good cook. The whole idea, which I was speaking of Swamiji, sort of defining, like, okay, self-realization is the goal, kriya is the practice. What do I fix when company comes to dinner? You know, do I just serve them nuts and raisins? Or do we, you know, what do we do? And Master had lots of recipes. His recipes haven't been published, but we can get access to them. And Sean was saying we're going to, you know, publish a book about health. And either in that book or in other books, we'll publish a lot of his recipes. Swamiji talked about Master's veggie burgers, mushroom burgers were particularly delicious. Master, one of his the early things he did was he started a restaurant. You may have seen pictures of it. It was right outside of Hollywood Church. And it was hugely successful. And it was just this little place there, and there was a huge sign on the top that said mushroom burgers. And it was a very, very successful restaurant. And after Master died, the people he left in charge, it was just so successful that it just took too much energy away from their whatever they were supposed to be doing, so they closed it. But that wasn't Master's energy. Master's energy was, well, let's give them good, healthy food cooked by devotees. You know, let's reach people through the vibrations of mushroom burgers. So you have that example in front of you. And Swamiji, I was saying this at the Guru Day retreat, in conversations with Yogananda, Swamiji says that Master's mission was, of course, for individuals to attain self-realization, but he also was looking for, you know, laborers in the field, and he said people who would understand that his work was not just an individual spiritual project, but it was also a project to uplift the world. That's what he says again in here, and I'll come to that in a moment. But Swamiji defined Master's mission, if I can remember all the pieces of it. He said, Master's mission was to teach a spiritual teaching that would apply equally to householders and to monastics. In other words, to unify the path of having a family and raising children with the traditional religious path of just being a monastic to show that the teachings, the same teachings apply to both. He wanted to show the education of children with spirituality as the goal. He wanted art. It was interesting. Swami said that one of Master's missions was to spiritualize the arts, to show art as a spiritual practice. He wanted to show also that truth is something that is joyfully proclaimed and not merely an angry protest against ignorance. Isn't that an interesting way to put it? Instead of it being a reaction against, it's just simply a statement for. And I believe there was a fifth point, but I don't remember right at the moment what it was. Do you remember? The question was,
where did we see this list recently? I'd like to make something out of it and put it in the community somewhere.
It's in Conversations with Master, Conversations with Yogananda. I think the only place it was heard was from me in the retreat recently. You think somebody else listed it out recently? Where was it?
I believe it was in one of the talks.
Oh, excellent. Superb.
I was just trying to see if I could find it in one of the weekends, and I remember there were 5 points.
Actually, then go to Conversations with Yogananda and look up Master's Mission in the index, because I took it right out of there. And there was another point to it, which I don't remember right at the moment. Okay, now all of that is to deal with these words in the Bhagavad Gita. Just leave it on, because whoever needs it next. In the Gita commentary, Swami makes a marvelous statement, which is ego, the definition of ego, is the soul identified with the physical body. And he says, because we are identified with our ego, and I love this phrase, we have the impression that the world is real. Isn't that interesting? That because we're so identified with our bodies and we live inside our material bodies and we perceive this world through the instrument of our material senses, it gives us the impression that this world is real. Of course, if we weren't identified with our bodies and were able to just see our bodies moving with divine energy, then we would, even if we were still moving our bodies, we would understand that this world is just one dimension of a much greater level of reality. Very interesting way to put it, isn't it? And he said also, because we get the impression this world is real, we feel the need to act. You know, we feel the need to respond to it. That's just natural, isn't it? You see a car coming, you move aside, you feel hungry, you want something to eat, you feel restless, you go to the movies, you feel cold, you put on a coat. Because we think this world is real, because we live inside these bodies, because we identify to it, we respond to it. You contrast that, for example, to Anandamoyi Ma, who was in such a state of detached ecstasy. She never used personal pronouns. Sometimes people affect that, referring, as we used to joke a lot, to this unit of consciousness. We used to have these people come through Ananda a lot who would never use personal pronouns. They would speak of this unit of consciousness. This unit of consciousness feels inspired. You mean you want to go to town? This unit of consciousness, you know, it's just like, come on, just get real with us. But Anandamoyi Ma never spoke of herself because she didn't identify with it. She would refer to this body, because she knew that there was this thing called this body, which she was responsible for and that people were relating to and so on. But it was this body. It wasn't my body. And it certainly wasn't I or me. And understanding that, when you hear Jesus use personal pronouns, you realize what he's also referring to, that there isn't the same identity with the self that he's speaking of. But she would say, I have to ask people whether I've eaten. I just don't even know whether I've eaten, because she was so unidentified with the body. Even Albert Einstein, who was not a saint, but of course had a very expanded reality, this is the story they tell about him, is that he kept observing these cramps in his stomach. He couldn't quite figure out what it was, and they realized he just wasn't eating. You know, because he was so in his mind that he just couldn't identify with the physical reality of his body enough to feed it. Well, that was Anandamoyi Ma. She was unidentified, and so she didn't, and as a consequence, she didn't feel any compulsion to act. She would just be, not in the tamasic way, the lazy way that people might imitate that. It was that there was nothing compelling her to act. She would just sit, and things would happen around her, and then she would feel what she actually called her kaal, which is the word for it, K-E-Y-A-L. Which is a Sanskrit word, which I think means like the divine impulse. and she would feel a divine impulse. And she traveled all over India, but she would move according to her kale. She would not have plans. She would not have an itinerary. She wouldn't ask people to book reservations for her. She would just feel moved to move. And literally, in the middle of the night, she would just get up from one ashram and head off to another place, and then all these people would scurry around to go with her. When she was alive, when you went to India, and this was before internet and so on, she died in 82, part of the project, if you wanted to see her, was you had to find her. And the whole story David tells, which he tells sometimes if you ask him, about his visit to Anandamoyi Ma, was how was he going to find her? And he tells the story about being in a restaurant and these women that they happened to be at the next table, and you know, this one led to this one, and then they called this one, and then they heard she was here, and then he got on this train, and you know, just all these different things. But it was all because, and there was nothing to say that she would still be there when he got there, because she just moved according to this inward call. And that inward call was dictated by what the Gita calls the desireless desire, which is most of human action is motivated by some inner, egoically related desire. But the other way that you can act in this world is what they call the desireless desire, to simply be an instrument to uplift others. And God is perfectly understands if one is seeking only one's self-realization, but the way they just always say it, they're very happy if you want to help. If you want to help others to draw closer, that's the mission of the masters. I remember I have explained to you many times that when I first came to Ananda Village, I had a single-minded definition of my purpose being there, which was that I was there to learn from Swami. And he was building a community, and I thought that was kind of cute, but I didn't think it had anything to do with me. And I was very proud of the fact that I was only there to learn from Swamiji, and I thought it was a sign of some kind of superior understanding to be disinclined to act in the world. You see, this is how the mind would work, isn't it? It's all a dream anyway. Why should I put out so much energy for those things? But then somewhere in that process, I observed that the man that I had come to learn from was working day and night to build this community. I mean, just a constant self-sacrificing outpouring of energy to build this community. And I had suddenly, you know, enough humility to think that maybe my idea was wrong. And my first inclination was not really that I thought the project was important, because I was just too deeply steeped in the thought that nothing in this world mattered, which was an affectation, really, because the fact of the matter was I was so attached to so many things in the world, not the least of which was my own idea about everything, that I did not behave as if nothing in this world mattered. I behaved as if every little thing mattered, because I had an opinion and a determined desire on everything in the name of being detached from it. You know how goofy it gets? But at least I thought, if he's going to work so hard for this and he's helping me so much, just as a friend, I ought to help him. So my inclination was, really you would call it Guru Seva. I was serving him as my teacher. But I was still serving him. The cause still didn't mean anything to me. It was only much, much later that I actually understood, well, just exactly what I was talking about before. Why do I want to define my own priorities? You know, what makes me think that I am qualified to say what's important and what's not important? If this is important to Swami, if Swami says this was important to Master, then it's important to me. That's just all there is to it. And it's a tricky business to understand how one does that with complete mental integrity, with complete intellectual integrity. I often try to explain that to people. It's, you know, I have this absolute faith in Swamiji based on nearly 40 years of experience. It's not like I just sort of thought that would be a nice idea. It's based on the fact that I've watched. You know, I've seen time after time after time. How many times does someone have to show you that they know what they're doing before you begin to think, he knows what he's doing? And how many times do you have to come a cropper discovering that you don't have the foggiest idea what you're doing before you just become very suspicious of your own ideas. And of course, the only way to develop spontaneous direct intuition is first to discipline your likes and dislikes. The reason we don't get divine guidance is because we're very narrow in what we're willing to hear. Really as simple as that. I wrote this up in the book also when I was having such a hard time understanding what I should do. And Swami told me it's very easy to know God's will. And I didn't find it easy at all. But the reason I didn't find it easy is because I had given God a list of what I would allow his will to be. And unfortunately, you know, what was in my best interest was not on my own list. And so I spent all my energy promising God that if he just told me, I'd do it. But the subtext to that was only if it fits here. So when he was trying to direct me here, I just blotted that out. All I could notice was that he wasn't answering me, so I would just beseech him ever more desperately until I had this encounter with Swamiji, and I realized, well, why is it so hard for me? Because my likes and dislikes cloud my intuition. It just couldn't be any simpler than that. And when Swamiji teaches how to have true intuition, he doesn't start with, you know, let's tune in and think about this and get in a circle and light a candle. He doesn't say any of that. He says it's the power of intuition comes from the constant, moment-by-moment discipline of overcoming your likes and dislikes. And really genuinely ask what is trying to happen here. With complete impartiality, that's how I describe Swamiji's, what I called his remarkable intelligence. It's because he's willing to know. You know, I can know a certain number of things, but there's a lot of things I don't want to know. I'm just amazed how blind I can be. And by extension, I've observed it in others, just certain things that we're willing to hear and other things scare us too much. But let's see, where was that? I can't quite remember. I was saying about taking it on as my own cause. And it was, to me, it looked like bondage to take it on as my own cause. And it took me a long time to understand that at the present stage of development that I and most of us are in, we're going to be working anyway. So we devote our energy to a divine cause that will help others, or do we just pass the time and then die? You know, I've often tried to recruit people, for example, to teach in our school. As you know, and I say, well, you know, you can teach in another school and you can do good work there and be very influential, but when you leave, the waters are just going to close over you. You know, what we're establishing in our school is a whole new system for teaching, and give your energy to that, and at the end of that time, you will have opened a channel where something entirely new will happen. I mean, we can look back, Montessori, Waldorf, it all started somewhere. That's why I often talk to people about the practice of tithing, which I'm going to make a little attempt to persuade you all to tithe again, which I do periodically, which would be immensely helpful to Ananda if more people would tithe. But the main thing is it would be immensely helpful to everyone because you're going to work anyway. So is your work going to be just the process of taking care of yourself and your family, you know, or are you going to in some way unite all of your actions to serving God? See, that's the astonishing beauty about tithing, which is that not everyone has the karmic opportunity to get up every morning and have every action of that day be in direct service to God. I'm going to come back to tithing in a minute, but I want to speak about just what I said for a minute. A very interesting factor of Swamiji's life, which, you know, he has a unique karma, and it's more than most people can reach, and it's not the destiny of all of us, so I don't want to make anyone feel badly for this thought. But from the time he met Master to the present day, including when he was thrown out of SRF and was absolutely penniless, he has never done anything that wasn't directly to serve and spread Master's teachings. And when he was thrown, he was 36 years old, he was penniless, he was living with his parents, there was no question. Whatever he was going to do, it had to serve the work. Now, it's true he's had to earn money in lots of different ways, but his thought of how to earn money has always been, I'll write music, I'll write a book, I'll go out and teach. But it's always the only thing he ever did that even slightly varied was that the Peace Corps offered him a job once to train people who were going to India. And this is when I was writing his biography. I said, you know, sir, I've observed this. You never did one thing just to support yourself. Everything. And then I mentioned the Peace Corps. I said, except for that Peace Corps job. He said, yes, but when it was offered to me, I thought I was going to be able to train them to understand India's spiritual side and be able to help. He said, when it turned out that's what they didn't want, he said, I just got other people to do it. Because they didn't want what I had. And then but he did add, he said, but a very small group of those Peace Corps volunteers sought him out, and he was able to teach them outside the regular program. But that's the only thing he ever took in all of his 60 years of discipleship, because it was impossible for him, at the state of development he is, to act on his own behalf. He could only act on behalf of the guru. And if he had to earn money, he would just earn money acting on behalf of the guru. And much of the time when people come to him with financial problems, he'll suggest something that also spreads the teaching. Now bear in mind, he's also encouraged people to start the construction company and the solar energy company and, you know, business, computer services businesses, because we all have different karma. So I don't want to make that too strong, because it isn't everybody's destiny. But this is where tithing comes in. Because tithing is that 10%, and I'm not going to, you know, give you the, oh, you can only just do half a percent, which a lot of people do, and you can. 10%, the first 10% of everything you earn isn't yours. You just give it to God. And that's how to take the situation we're in, where we have to spend a great deal of our energy doing something else, and make every action we take, the 10% of it, goes directly, and the way it's described is to the source of your inspiration. Whatever it is that's drawing you to God, then by your daily labors you support that. And by supporting it, one, you're expressing gratitude for everything you're given, and also you're serving other people, because your job may be to be a scientist or to be a doctor or to be a businessman or, you know, to be an artist, whatever it might be. It's just not your karma to stand up every day and teach people to meditate. But nonetheless, as you're a scientist, an artist, a doctor, you're just knowing that all the work that I'm doing, 10% of it is going to help that cause. And you see how it completely changes your relationship to what you're doing? And then your ambition, and the more you have, you become a partner. You see how everything would be different? I've said this so many times to people, and I know that there's just some enormous barrier that people have to get across, because the number of people who actually just take the first 10% of everything they earn and get and just give it to God, I mean, I think you should give it to Ananda, because after all, you're sitting here, but I don't care where you give it. The point is to give it, because then your egoically motivated actions to that extent are spiritualized, and it builds freedom for you. It breaks that thought that the material world is real and there I have to act in it. Swami also writes in here, he said, ego-motivated ideas seem like just simple common sense. But in the end, they don't bring you what you're seeking. Because in the end, they simply reinforce the false idea that I am this body. And the happiness we're seeking will not come to us through that identification. It will only come to us when our consciousness expands. And the idea that I can't afford to give away the money, and people will show me the math. I think if you're that poor, you can't afford not to. Because are you really just going to rely on yourself? Do you honestly think that your little ego can actually make you safe? That to me is a really, really scary idea. It's a much scarier idea than giving away 10% of your money. If you're giving away 10% of your money, then... And see, it's so beautiful, because if you're poor, you give away a little money. And if you're rich, you give away a lot of money. And both sides of the equation, the people freak out. You know, because I'm poor, I can't afford it. Because I'm rich, it's so much. You know? And so both sides of them, people are just nervous, because ego-motivated ideas seem like they have such common sense. How can this possibly be the right thing for me to do? After all, I have to be practical. After all, I have... But we have to just move into a whole different reality. What would God want me to do? And that's why I emphasize Swamiji. Swamiji created Ananda from nothing. Nothing. That's a very interesting concept. Nothing. I stayed in the his house in Atherton with his parents when his father had a heart attack. So I know the house he lived in for a little while. It wasn't his childhood home, but it was where his parents were when he was thrown out of SRF. He was just alone in that room. And look, you know, that's the material success course. That's how that came about. That's another element, but okay. Let me think for a moment. Actually, I want to speak about the material success course. It just came into my mind, and it's a very good reality. You see, this is just the commentary on the Gita, but the issue that Swamiji is addressing, because Krishna addressed it with so much force, and it's an eternal debate in India between karma yoga and meditation, as if they were separate realities, and what does the Gita recommend? And there are people who say the Gita just tells you to serve the world. Right action is the right way. The superior being acts. But the subtlety of that is the superior being acts in such a way as to diminish the ego and expand our identity with spirit. He says, let me just think about this. Oh, the entire issue, and it says in here, is to act without self-interest, with the consciousness that it is the divine energy flowing through us. I think I mentioned it in one of these earlier classes, but it's so interesting how Swami in the Revelations book talks about how the good, world-serving, church-going Christian, even though he displays many positive qualities, is really much farther behind spiritually than he may realize, because no matter how much good he does, he always thinks that he himself is doing it. Because the thought hasn't entered into the liturgy that the ego itself is the dream and that whatever energy is coming through you is really the divine energy. This is where Krishna says, I never cease to act, and wherever any good action, serviceful action is done, there I am doing it. And what he's trying to say is, this is the thought form that we ourselves are supposed to have. And this goes back to the attunement that I was talking about at the beginning. Do I act merely according to what my ego-motivated common sense tells me about the material world, and this is how I'm supposed to be? Or do I constantly discipline that ego inclination to take this world as real and identify with the divine spirit moving within me? And Master says in here, and Krishna says, you know, the real work that we have is to inwardly connect to that spirit and then radiate that energy outward. Now, on our particular path at this particular time, we're not asked merely to sit and meditate and radiate that energy. There are times, and I'm sure we've lived those lives too, of just contemplative prayer. In fact, Swamiji has talked about, as a possibility for Anand in the future, you know, just like Master laid out so many things that he never was able to accomplish, Swami has laid out many things, because there are people, part of our spiritual family, who could thrive in a purely contemplative life. And he suggested that people could have the job of praying for people, and that we could have a prayer ministry that was so dynamic that there were monastics who simply, their work was they would just spend their days praying for people. But it would be still profoundly spiritual work, because it would be radiating outward from their inner perception of God. And that's why he said, even if a master comes in this world and does no outward work, he still does more for the world than 1,000 busy, egocentric people who are working for all these good causes. Because no matter how much we try to make all the ocean waves go up, they inevitably go down again. It's just the way it is. I was reading when we were in Los Angeles, and the Los Angeles Times came. They talked about Baker. What's her name? Tammy Faye Baker, right. Of course, whose life has gone up and down, and it just chronicled how, you know, she and her husband were inspired to be evangelicals, and so they were doing this evangelical work, and the whole long obituary says, and they had this puppet show, and Pat Robertson, I guess, or who was big and important, saw their puppet show, and he swept them into it. And before they knew it, they were these huge television evangelists, and they were making millions of dollars. And there was a marvelous line in there, because eventually, of course, her husband was indicted for fraudulently directing all this money to them in this lavish lifestyle. She was quoted as saying, "We didn't really live any differently than any of the other televangelists," she said. That ranks with, I saw that film, I think it's called The Smartest Guys in the Room. It was about Enron. It's actually a very interesting documentary. And at one point, you know, just under the category of how stupid can you be, one of the people who I think was later indicted, I can't remember who it was, when it came out that the company had just been looted and all these people had lost their pensions and their stocks and, you know, people who'd spent their whole lives, where they were just ruined, one of the big executives talked about how it was difficult for them too. You know, that what had been worth $50 million yesterday was only worth like $12 or $15 million today. He actually just said that, you know, like it was hard on his family too. You know, it was Kenley's wife. What planet do these people come from? Well, but you know, it's just all relative. I had someone come to me once and it was sincere. She was embarrassed, but she was sincere because something had happened in their lives and, you know, they were making $180,000 and now they're only making $140,000. Well, if you've committed that extra $40,000, that's a real loss. But she knew that in the great scale of things, this was not a real problem. But in her reality, it was a real problem, and she was very upset about it. And I mean, I had to take her seriously because she was. This is just the way it all is. But you know what? And so Tammy Faye Baker, they just became really, really rich, and then her husband was disgraced, and it was all destroyed. And then she kind of rose up with someone else again, and then he too went to jail for some reason or another. And no, it's just like up and down and up and down and up and down. And we try to help starving people and we try to help these people and that people. And the poor ye have always with you. This is what Jesus talked about too. When Mary Magdalene came and wasted all that money just putting ointment on his feet. And that's what Judas said. That was a waste of money. You could have given this money to the poor. Jesus said, the poor you will always have with you. He said, but not, I will not always be here. Very profound statement. Meaning, if you devote yourself to attunement with the guru, everything else will follow. If you try to think that you're going to make it right by this external reality, the waves will always go up and down and up and down and up and down. And that's not about how you spend your time. That's about what you think you're doing inside yourself. You can spend your time helping the homeless. You can spend your time being a missionary in Africa. Frank Laubach was one of the great mystical saints of our time, and he was a missionary to the Philippines, you know, trying to teach the Muslims. He ended up teaching them more to read than about Christ. But in what he was doing, what he was really doing was in a constant state of trying to act consciously as Christ's instrument, in a constant state of remembrance. That makes whatever you're doing spiritual work. Don't be so naive as to think just because you are a clerk at the department store. Coming back to Swami's Material Success course, it was very interesting. I'll just go for a few more minutes and we'll take a break. There's this lovely lady named Eloise who's from England, and she has some significant job internationally. She does some kind of contract work for a tech company. I really could never quite get a bead on it. She works in 24 countries. She has a huge global work that she does. She said, the way she put it was, she said she was absolutely drying up and dying in that job a couple of years ago. And then she got her hands on Swami's material success through yogic principles. She was already materially successful. She just has a cross-cultural heart. But she got those lessons. You do. Because that's what it's about. Job, it's in the family. So she just, for the last, every completely come total. So she used work and compelled her action. That's a translated philosophy. Because what he has told us in that course is, you have nothing and you want to build something, this is how you do it. And he's just explained line by line how he did it. And translated it then into very, very practical ways of how we can do it. See, these are all the building blocks of a new society. This is the desireless desire to uplift the world that Swami has exemplified. Our job in relationship to that as disciples is to find whatever elements of our teachings that have been given to us. And there's way too many for everyone to do. I was so charmed by Eloise because of just her passionate commitment to this. Because she's been living in England. She hasn't even been in this country. But it's just like she just grabbed that and really has made it her own and turned what would otherwise just be a materialistic life into a really profoundly spiritual one. It's a really beautiful thing. Precisely what Master's saying in here for us to do. Okay, let's take a break. Okay. You ready? Are there any comments or questions? I had a question during the break. Are there any others? The question during the break is the very important question, which is, am I actually speaking? Carol asked me, what about Cesar Chavez and all the work he did to uplift the migrant workers, and what about the civil rights movement? And one has to appreciate that God inspires people to do good work to move society forward. It's not as if what we're talking about is nuances of people's thought. I mean, Swamiji says in here, you know, you can ban the bomb all you want to, but as long as people are angry, they're going to fight. And if all they have is pitchforks, they'll fight with pitchforks, but they'll still fight. You can't change the external system and expect it to bring about a change in consciousness. People tend to think, oh, I'll just change the system. People's consciousness is formed by the system. No, that's not actually true. People's consciousness forms the system. And they will make the systems. And people often, you know, there'll be a really dilapidated place where people who don't work very much live, and then they'll move them all into a brand new place, and in a short period of time it will become dilapidated. I don't mean that in a prejudicial way. But a certain consciousness creates a certain reality. Not by any means is everybody who's, you know, happens to be down on their luck have that consciousness. But sometimes things work together. I mean, that's what's so frustrating often when we go to India, because it's so dirty in so many places. And you think, for heaven's sakes, can't these people just clean it up? You know, it's just, why is it so dirty? Why is there such a tamasic energy? But there's just a lot of people with a very tamasic energy. And so they just live in squalor like that. And then you'll see people who are very poor but are extremely refined in the way that they relate, even if they have nothing. It's very, very neat, and it's just the way their consciousness is. But what Swami was speaking about specifically, primarily, is the thought that you will actually affect the overall reality of the world just by changing the systems. You put all this millions of dollars into the Democrat versus the Republican, or the Republican versus the Democrat, and then, you know, in a short period of time, it's all the same. Somebody gets in charge and they suppress the others, and then the balance shifts, and then these people get in charge and they suppress that one. And at the end result, what do you really end up with? Now, Cesar Chavez was inspired by Martin Luther King, who was inspired by Mahatma Gandhi, who was working from the Bhagavad Gita. Martin Luther King's whole effort was God-inspired. That and whole movement came out of the churches. Maybe they didn't have a Kriya Yoga practice, but those people acted with extraordinary courage and selflessness and an identification with a much larger reality than their own lives. They put their own lives on the line and suffered a great deal. So it was definitely moving beyond the ego in order to create something. And what it's that tapasya, that devotional self-offering, is the magnetism that brings a new consciousness into things. And what happened with Martin Luther King is that he was the instrument of a new consciousness really coming in. It's a rising age, and he was God-inspired to act in the way that he inspired. And the result is, you know, people just, it's appalling to think of behaving in the way that people behaved perfectly comfortably 60 or 70 years ago. You know, now they're putting these poor old men on trial for things they did in their youth when they were in the Ku Klux Klan, for murders they committed and just got away with. But so, I mean, it's within the span of one lifetime that consciousness has changed. Of course, what they really were is they were acting on behalf of a changing consciousness. And the extent to which what they did actually changed them is the extent to which they did it egoically, or they did it with a true selfless embracing of a cause larger than their own. Swamiji has encouraged people, you know, if you feel inspired to help in some certain way, by all means help, but do it with the right consciousness. Because if you're radiating what you feel inside of you, then you're doing spiritual work. That's what makes it spiritual work, whatever it might be. It can be a political cause. It can be just washing dishes. If you're radiating spirit from inside, then you're doing spiritual work. Because the only thing that ever has lasting effect on the world is change of consciousness. What Martin Luther King did, validly, was he exposed a consciousness, and there was enough elevated consciousness to be appalled by what they saw, and it just changed the consciousness of the whole country. I mean, when the key point was when that man sprayed them all with the fire hoses, and Sheila Rush, Naidruva is her name now, she's a black woman who lives at Ananda, and she's just a few years older than I am, and she felt inspired by God after she graduated from college to go to law school, even though she had no particular interest in being a lawyer. But she really felt she was supposed to. And as soon as she graduated, she went to work for Martin Luther King. She never got to the South. They wouldn't let her go to the South because she was a lawyer and they wanted her to work in the North. But she worked a lot for him. But she tells fascinating stories about, I mean, and maybe this is a well-known fact, but as I recall, you know, Martin Luther King was a master tactician. And he really knew what he was doing. And there was a certain point of, I think it was when they were on that bridge, but he at a certain point, he instructed them. He said, at that point, everyone should kneel and pray. And he knew what, number one, it would create the most magnificent picture that would just tear the hearts out of everybody who saw it. Second thing is, he said, is then people won't be able to run away. That was just, you know, it's like, that'll help give them the courage to stay there, and it'll help cause them to stay there because they'll just put themselves on the line. I mean, that's what people wanted. But you know, that's real power. We made a slight error, too, when we did our play here, even though our play on Martin Luther King was magnificent, because just sort of for fun and for other reasons, they'd used a lot of jivey music at that time. But the civil rights movement came out of the churches. It came out of hymns. And all that music was actually a huge split in the black community when people took what had been gospel and made it popular. Because the civil rights movement could not come out of the popular music. Popular music would not have given people the power to kneel in front of the dogs. It had to be from the hymns. Because they really were. They were God-inspired. I mean, there are times when God inspires you. God inspires righteous war. I mean, the fight against Hitler was a righteous war. The American Revolution was a righteous war. You know, William the Conqueror came in and he was a warrior. It's a righteous war. You can't tell from what's going on the outside. You can only tell from what's going on the inside. That's why consciousness is everything. That's why Eloise is, you know, taking up those material success lessons and then just continuing her, you know, international executive life. But for her, it had turned into something completely else. Because every day she was using those principles. Plus, it made her very successful. Because she was able to just solve problems. Because her consciousness was other-centered. It wasn't self-centered anymore. Now, let's see. Any other questions or thoughts? I have to think what else I have to say here. Oh, I know what I was going to say. You know, you look at the problems of the world, and there's so many problems in this world. It's just heartbreaking. But the solutions are all there. There's just no consciousness to implement them. And that's where people just sort of crash and burn in the effort to help this world. And that's more what I'm speaking of, Carol. It's like, you know, let's feed all the children. Let's stop the genocide. Let's, you know, end the blood diamonds. I mean, there's just... the causes are just literally overwhelming. But all of it could be solved. It would not be difficult to solve. It's just we would distribute things more evenly, people would live more generously, bad people wouldn't grab for power anymore, but come on, they will. It's all about consciousness, and we shift consciousness piece by piece. That's what Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez also did. You know, they exposed in a very effective way at the right time. They were God-inspired. It was like, this is the right moment to do it. And they acted with that. You know, Martin Luther King prayed deeply. Gandhi prayed continuously. They didn't act from, oh, this will be a good idea, that'll be a good idea. They act from what as clearly as they could from what they felt God-inspired to do, and it worked. The American Revolution was really quite remarkable, the depth of spiritual energy in that. It was interesting for us because those of us who went through the SRF lawsuit, and I don't want to, in a way, the SRF lawsuit was a fight for freedom. It was, when we started that lawsuit, the whole world believed that Self-Realization Fellowship owned everything that belonged to Master, and through the course of that lawsuit, it was proven that they owned almost nothing. It was just an absolute boomerang karma for them. No one even questioned that they owned these things when we started, and by the end, their copyrights and trademarks had all been canceled. So it was, and this vast amount of public domain material that nobody knew existed was all exposed. So the end of it was Master for the World. If, you know, not everyone follows it, but in 1990, there were no advertisements for Babaji and Kriya Yoga and Yogananda this and everything. If you look at 1990 magazines, there was nothing. Because everyone was afraid, because SRF would send their lawyers if you did anything. And then it just completely broke open. Now you pick up any magazine, it's just filled with Yogananda, Babaji, Sri Yukteswar Lahiri, just everywhere. And they can't do anything about it because it wasn't there. It was and Swamiji, you know, talks about the David and Goliath nature of it. He mentions it several times. They had the third largest law firm in the country. We had John Parsons, who was the sole practitioner who didn't even have a secretary. Just his office is still around the corner here on Park Avenue. Poor John. He was, Sheila knew him because she had been doing a job here. She had a law project in East Palo Alto. She was helping poor people get legal representation by using law students. That was her job. And John was on the board of directors. So when SRF sued us, she knew John. We didn't even have a lawyer. Ananda didn't even have a lawyer. So we called Sheila, who was a lawyer. Do you know any lawyer? She says, well, John's on my board. She'd never even met him. She'd only talked to him on the phone. But he was, maybe she had met him, but he was a good man. And so I called him up, and I said, we have this problem with sort of trademark copyright. And he said, well, my specialty happens to be intellectual property. And then I think Swami called him, and the way John tells the story is this nice old man called me up and said, he has this little problem with trademark and copyright. And so John said, sure, I can handle that. You know, not having any idea that for 12 years it would rule his life. He had no idea what he was getting into. And he says, of course, if he did know, he would never have done it. He tried at a certain point, I think, to try to get out of it, but by that point it was too late. Eventually we added, by the very end, we added a larger law firm, but we didn't add a larger law firm. We found another lawyer who had as much integrity as John did, and we added him because it was just way beyond what John could do. But where is all that? When I read The American Revolution, and you read John Adams and Alexander Hamilton and other of them, the words they use are very, very familiar. There was just this divine certainty about what they were doing, and they said it like that. They felt that God wanted them to do this, and they felt that that divine certainty would bring them victory. Because, you know, the American Revolution was no walk in the park. That war, we lost. The Americans did not win that easily. You know, I'm not much of a history buff, and most people don't really know, but now there's a lot of popular history I've been reading. It was like we just lost and lost and lost and lost, and England was this huge country, and America was not by any means a huge and wealthy, and America was not even united, really, in its efforts. As many solid Americans were against it, but there was this small handful of people who had absolute certainty. And it wasn't the absolute certainty of dogmatism. It was the absolute certainty of this inner inspiration that God wanted them to do this. And they acted for that reason in a very self-sacrificing manner. Most all of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, almost all of them, you know, they lost their properties, some lost their lives. It was very self-sacrificing, but they never doubted. They just knew they would win. And so no matter what happened against them, they didn't use ego-motivated common sense. They used just the calm and quiet certainty that this is what God wants. Now that's what we're talking about. But you see, they were completely engaged. They were even, you know, shooting. They were shooting and killing other people. But they weren't acting with ego-motivated common sense. They were acting from a deep inner understanding that this is the life God has given me. That's why you can't say any system. You know, many people are meant to be soldiers. you can't just declare pacifism is the right way to be, or that nobody should go to war. Because for some people, they're inspired by God to go be soldiers, because that's how they're going to radiate the divine from within them. And they can act with courage and divine understanding, whether they even know it or not, they're often doing that. And we went through that SRF thing. There was, you know, we just knew we would win in the end, one way or another. And it really, you know, that we weren't by any means constantly filled with faith. We had many dark nights. But there was just this, we have no choice. This is what we must do. I'm sure that Cesar Chavez and Martin Luther King, you know, Martin Luther King's poor wife, I mean, it was not the life that she signed up for. They had moved out of the South. They were living in the North. They were doing very well. And then he went back to the South. It was like, for her, it was like, why are we doing this? And yet everything had to be sacrificed because he felt that's what God wanted him to do. It doesn't mean that you always have to sacrifice, but you always have to act. Now see, this is freedom through action. It's not merely just doing things, and it's not merely running around doing good things. It's doing those things that you're inwardly inspired to do with the consciousness that I'm doing this because I'm inwardly inspired with the connectedness to the divine. That's where all the rest of what Swamiji has given us is so helpful, including, which I will emphasize again, tithing, material success course, artist as a channel, leadership, whatever it is. How do I do this with self-realization as the goal? And this is what our masters have given us. So that's my whole story for tonight. Is there any questions or thoughts before we give it up? Okay. I'll see you Sunday.